in person.
Yes.
It was powerful.
Yes.
So we're going to tell our stories any way we can, even if the governor vetoes it.
Thank you for taking this time for us. Really appreciate speaking with you.
No, thank you. Really
Take
appreciate
care.
It.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
You are tuned to KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Once a Braided River on Tuesday, May 16th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Cinema 21 in Portland. Once a Braided River is a documentary film by Barbara Bernstein. The film tells the story of the Willamette River before it was transformed into a Superfund site. The documentary features community groups and activists working to replace the zone and explores their vision to reclaim this stretch of river as a place where people and wildlife can thrive. Again, that's Once a Braided River on Tuesday, May 16th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Cinema 21, 616 Northwest 21st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Saddle up and ride with country music in your head from 6 till 9 every Saturday morning on KBOO Swingin' Country. You can count on Swingin' Country's stable of rotating hosts to fill your early morning with country, alternative country, western, western swing, and even some rockabilly, bluegrass, and Americana tunes. Swingin' Country on KBOO is mighty fine, Saturday morning, 6 to 9.
If your eyes are on me, you're looking at country.
KBOO.
Hello and welcome to the KBOO Radio Bike Show, broadcasting live from Portland, Oregon on 90.7 FM and streaming live on kboo.fm. All shows are also available at www.bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. My name is Alon Robb, and I will be joined today by co-host Nedra Deadweiler. Our engineer is Ray Bodwell. We are happy that you, the listeners, are here with us today. I want to extend a special welcome to an Iranian friend who is listening to us in Tehran. Nedra, good morning. How are you today?
Doing great, Alon.
What's new in your life, in your city? Give us the Reader's Digest version.
Reader's Digest version. We're having a beautiful spring day. Cool breeze. What else is happening? I just met with a lovely person. She has a community circle, and it is bringing people back to the park to develop relationship with nature and each other. And so there's a lot of great things that are populating and bringing people together.
Great. I like hearing news like that. So I will say bye for now, and we will reconnect around the half hour.
Sounds great. Have a good interview.
Thank you. I hope this day finds you, the listeners, well and healthy. After several rainy and snowy months in Portland, we had 2 weeks of sunshine. Additional warmth and light came in the form of an energizing and inspiring conference called the Active Transportation Summit, organized by Portland Street Trust, a gathering of people working to make transportation in Oregon and beyond more accessible and just. I also felt warmth and hope when I joined the Earth Day Climate Youth March, and a few days later, a spirited rally outside City Hall, organized by BikeLoud PDX. At the rally, we were joined by four-legged family member, Gino Nugget Bartali, who rode in the box attached to the back of the bike, and joined with barks and howls when participants at the rally cheered. This is not surprising, as a little cyclist is named for Gino Bartali, an Italian cycling champion and member of the anti-fascist resistance who hid Jewish friends in his home and smuggled documents in his bike seat and frame, an inspiring man in every generation. In the first half of the show, our guest here in the studio is climate scientist David Goodrich, author of several wonderful books about cycling and life, including his just released On Freedom Road, Bicycle Explorations and Reckoning on the Underground Railroad. He will read from this book tonight at Powell's Bookstore at 7 o'clock. In the second half of the show, co-host Nedra Deadweiler will speak with bicycle activist Lindsay Caron Epstein, who survived being hit by a driver and several weeks of being close to death, and is once again riding and engaging in bicycle advocacy while carrying a message of survival, courage, and healing. Our first guest today, Dr. David Goodrich, is a scientist who was director of the UN Global Climate Observing System in Geneva, Switzerland, and retired as head of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Climate Observation and Monitoring Program. He is a passionate cyclist whose travels have carried him far and wide. Besides many academic writings, his work includes the books A Hole in the Wind, about a trip from Delaware to Oregon, A Voyage Across an Ancient Ocean, a bicycle journey through the Northern Dominion of Oil, and the just released On Freedom Road, Bicycle Explorations and Reckoning, the Underground Railroad. Good morning, Dr. Goodrich, and welcome to The Bike Show. We are happy to be with you today.
It's wonderful to be here, Alon. Thanks very much for having me.
Before we get to your journeys and accounts of them, maybe you could tell us a little bit about your own bicycle history. Were you always a cyclist?
Not at all. I didn't learn to ride a bike until I was in college. But I started bicycle commuting in the early 90s to my work. And then gradually I started realizing that there were people that do these transcontinental trips, and more that's kind of lodged in the back of my head. Mm-hmm. And that was something that I wanted to do when I retired. But then the first big trip I took was in 2000, following the route of the Nez Perce, mm-hmm, from eastern Washington to Idaho through Montana.
Mm-hmm. And you're a climate scientist, now retired, and worked at influential U.S. and U.N. organizations. What did the work entail?
Basically, the work at the United Nations, it was involved in keeping the observing networks together. I mean, in places like Darfur in Sudan, you still have people who are launching weather balloons and things like that. So keeping the networks that give us an idea of how climate is changing, keeping those networks intact was a lot of what I was doing.
And at the U.S. and in the United States, what did your job entail?
The United States was mostly involved in almost like the U.S. side of those observations. So the U.S. also deploys some pretty extensive ocean observing networks. There are floats that drop down to several kilometers, profiling the upper ocean, and we helped keep those networks going.
And you're not responsible for getting the U.S. out of the climate, the Paris climate. You have nothing to do with that.
Not at all. Not at all.
Okay. So the first trip, how did that go? In 2000.
That trip in 2000 started flying into Spokane, and I remember the west was burning that year, and flying over and seeing a lot of the fires and figuring out how I was going to get make my way through that. But I remember I had a fall right out of Spokane on a dirt road. I got lost. I had a fall into the dirt, and I remember picking myself up, and my leg was all chewed up, and I remember thinking, wow, man, I feel beat up. I feel old. And then I just sort of this epiphany, but I don't feel weak. And that was something that kind of kept me going.
Hmm. And you followed the Nez Perce, their travels?
Yes. I came through through Lewiston and then across Lola Pass into Montana, and eventually, in a few rides later, made it to the place called the Bear Paw in Montana, where the Nez Perce were stopped literally in sight of the hills of Canada.
And you met members of the Nez Perce Nation, and
yes, uh-huh. Yes, when I was going across,
Your first book is called A Hole in the Wind. Can you tell us about that book?
Sure. That was sort of a bucket list thing. Mm-hmm. When I retired from NOAA, I thought, okay, what I want to do is to ride across, ride from Delaware to Oregon. And my particular angle on it is maybe I can see some things from a bicycle seat about climate change mm-hmm. that you can't necessarily see from the satellites or from the remote instruments mm-hmm. that I was used to using. So I rode across. Probably the thing that struck me the most was, you know, in my own mental bulletin board, I had the Rockies. It's like, okay, this is going to be the big climb. Mm-hmm. And I crossed the Rockies at Cameron Pass behind Fort Collins, Colorado. And I remember as I was getting close to the summit, and I was really beat because I was carrying full camping gear and everything. Was about 2 days and 5,000 feet of elevation. And when I got to the top, it's like, wait, the forests are all gray. And it struck me that I knew what was going on there. I'd read about it. This was the mountain pine beetle infestation, where the winters are not cold enough or the winters are not long enough to prevent two generations of beetles from attacking the trees. And the trees have not evolved to defend against that. And you see all over the High West the effects of beetle infestations that are one of those secondary effects of climate change.
Hmm. And one of the main causes of climate change you explored in your second book, where you traveled along the upper Midwest and Canada's prairies, and an area where tar sands and oil reserves are king. What did you learn during that journey? And actually, during the first journey, what did you learn that you didn't know before about climate and how to...
Maybe first question first. Mm-hmm. I started out in Fort McMurray, Alberta, which is the town that's the center of where the tar sands come from. And it's something that's so vast that you need... I chartered a plane because you really need to see it from the air. A lot of it, if you're just driving along, you can see forests by the side of the road that have been reclaimed. Mm. But it's like the forests are just thin strips along the road. In a lot of it, they're sort of these Potemkin forests. But it is it's a massive operation. The tailings ponds from the tar sands are some of the biggest man-made structures on the planet. So ponds is certainly a euphemism. And you also get the idea, I mean, everyone who's in Fort McMurray is involved in the oil business, involved in this huge enterprise. And I remember talking to one of the guys up there, his job was a power engineer, and he says, look, just tell the people, you know, tell folks you run into, we're not bad people up here. We're trying to do things, you know, as cleanly as we can. And like you, we've got families and retirements and a community that we've built here. Hmm. So it's kind of this I mean, clearly what's coming out of the tar sands, it's one of the biggest carbon sources on the planet. And in a lot of ways, the Keystone Pipeline was referred to as the drain for that for that huge carbon source. So you're trading off between people that need, you know, these are people's jobs and livelihoods against a genuine peril to the planet.
And did you meet climate deniers on your trip, or how did they treat you?
Well, it's funny. I was treated very well. I don't think you know, anyone ever meant me harm. There were some times where you know, when I check in at a I remember checking in at a hotel in Kansas, and the I told the desk clerk what I was doing, and she said, "Oh, do you know Al Gore?" It's like, no, I've certainly heard him speak, but it's like, I know where you're coming from. And, you know, and I remember overhearing some farmers talking about, oh yeah, there's a lot of money in that climate change thing. Get yourself a government grant. It's like,
And as a scientist, you know how easy it is to get government grants.
Yeah.
You are listening to the KBO Radio Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon on 90.7 FM and streaming live on KBOO.FM. My name is Alon Rab, and my co-host is Nedra Detweiler. And we are speaking with climate scientist and author Dr. David Goodrich, whose new book, just published, is called On Freedom Road, Bicycle Explorations and Reckoning on the Underground Railroad. We could probably talk a few more hours about the first two books, but I'd like to get to the third book. But before that, you mentioned that the bicycle is a wonderful story machine, you call it. Can you explain what you mean? How did using a bicycle help you along the way?
I think in particular, when I'm riding solo, it's very easy to just bump into people. You are the least intimidating stranger that anyone's going to see. You have the slowest getaway vehicle around, and you get to talk. I think one of the things that happened in this book, as an example, we were trying to get into a chapel called Star Hill Chapel in Dover, Delaware, which has a history of Underground Railroad activities, and I could not contact the pastor there. And finally, we just sort of said, well, it's Sunday morning, why don't we just show up? Mm-hmm. And they were very kind to us. They let us in. It's like we're trying to be inconspicuous, you know, some three white folks in the back of an AME church. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sweaty and in spandex, so we weren't very successful. And as we're sitting there, these two ladies in the sort of white doily hats leave, and they come back with glasses of ice water for us. And it was just, and after the service, it was magical. It was kind of like they were embracing us. So it was very neat.
One of the things I really enjoyed about your book was the lively descriptions. You have a great way, attention to detail. In that particular instance, I enjoyed the way you describe the minister and also the local historian and the tradition. So tell us about following the Underground Railroad. What paths did you follow, and how did you decide to go on this trip?
When I first rode across to across the U.S., I came upon a local museum in Illinois where the docent there handed me this heavy brass ring and said, "Do you know what that is?" I said, "No." She said, "Well, that's a slave collar." And I kind of took a deep breath and put it down and came to realize that I was crossing this other invisible stream. And that kind of got into the back of my head that I should do that. Also, on the other side of the Atlantic, when I was, we went to visit where my ancestors come from. There's a Goodrich Castle that's something of a fixer-upper. But they're also at a museum in Bristol, England. There was an exhibit for a John Goodrich, who had been a captain on the Middle Passage. And that was kind of a revelation to me as well. So all of this kind of bubbled in the back of my head. The Adventure Cycling Association has an Underground Railroad route, and I thought that would be a place to start. So I started from from Jackson, Mississippi, and went up to Lake Erie on this the Underground Railroad route from Adventure Cycling. And then later, some years later, followed Harriet Tubman's route from Cambridge, Maryland, to St. Catharines, Ontario, which was about 1,000 miles. Hmm. That's a little closer to my hometown.
Hmm. And it was interesting to see the connection to our lives today, even the fact that you mentioned on the golf course 3 miles from your home, there's, you know, a historical connection, and Harriet Tubman was at a place in New York and Brooklyn where it's a bar now. So those connections are really interesting. Who are some of the people you met on this journey?
I think one of the people that was the most influential was a couple, Paul and Mary Liz Stewart in Albany, New York, who restored an Underground Railroad house where we know that Harriet Tubman stayed. But they were also influential in the recovery of the there were graves of 14 enslaved people at a place called Schuyler Flats, and it took the people of Albany 10 years to figure out what should we do with these remains. What would these people want to have done with them? And what ended up happening was this amazing celebration, if you will, where people all around the Northeast, woodworkers and artists, developed these ossuaries, these elaborate wooden mm-hmm. boxes to hold the bones of the people, and they were reburied in a ceremony that was at the mansion, the Schuyler Mansion in Albany, of the man who enslaved them. Mm-hmm. And people remember that to this day, and Paul and Mary Liz Stewart were right in the middle of that of the Schuyler Flats. So that definitely stuck with me. I still have that picture of the ossuaries from the Myers residence in Albany.
During this journey, did you meet people who maybe wish that black people were again slaves? Did you meet members of right-wing militias?
No, I can't say that I've ever really met anybody that meant me harm certainly not that gave me any kind of a hard time. On a bike, you're pretty unthreatening. Mm-hmm. It's more like in the, in the middle of Indiana, you find somebody who's bought you lunch.
And you mentioned, and when I was reading your book, there were a few little, you know, mishaps, or a flat tire, or being in a storm, or a dog accompanying a ranger peeing on your tent. Just a few hours after you were, you know, looking at the great sky and thinking about the universe.
Yeah.
But most of your trips have been thankfully safe and full of good connections with people.
And I find that in bicycle touring, in distance touring, I remember stuff that I was doing 12 years ago almost hour by hour when I was on tour. I couldn't tell you what I was doing an hour ago now, but I start thinking about, where was that particular place in Walport, Oregon? We were there yesterday, which was where I finally got to the ocean. It's like, oh yeah, I remember the smell of salt air coming down the river there.
our time has just been flying by really fast. There are many things I still would like to ask you about, you know, special training that you might have had before your journey, advice for people who want to go. But since our time is really just zooming by, if it's okay, I you know, maybe you could read the last few pages of your book, which to me sum pretty well the sense of hope that I got from your book, and you know, an ability to look at the past and not flinch, but actually deal with difficult questions. So if it's okay and you could read a few pages, that would be great.
Sure, happy to.
Thank you.
None of the present deliberate amnesia is new. In his 1935 book, Black Reconstruction in America, W.E.B. Du Bois wrote, "One is astonished in the study of history at the recurrence of the idea that evil must be forgotten, distorted, skimmed over." Brian Stevenson, founder of the Equal Justice Initiative, puts it this way: "There's a kind of smog in the air that's created by the history of slavery and lynching and segregation, and I don't think we can be free until we address this problem. I think it's important we understand all the brutal, all the ugly details, because those are things that might allow us one day to lay claim to something really beautiful." One stop on the ride in Albany helped me to glimpse the beauty that Stevenson wrote about. At the Myers residence, which I mentioned to you, Paul Stewart wrote a story for us about the discovery of the remains of the 14 enslaved people at Schuyler Flats and how the people of Albany decided to honor them. That story still reverberates. In 2021, historian Jill Lepore interviewed Cordell Reeves, who was working for the New York State Office of Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation, when he learned about the discovery of the remains. Lepore gives Reeves' account of the reburial over a decade later. "The dead lay in state in front of Schuyler Mansion before the multi-faith burial, one of the best attended and most moving public history events the state has ever hosted. Reeves wept. It was like lightning struck, he told me. All that night and next day, people read poems, sang, and danced. Something about this captured people," Reeves said, tearing up again. "I'm not sure what it was, but I keep coming back to the word reconciliation." I can't pretend to know what reconciliation looks like, but a string of voices through history to today, from Du Bois to Baldwin to Stevenson, tells us that we can't keep reburying our past. National trauma, like a wound, tends to heal when it's exposed to air. For me, that road began at a rural museum in Illinois. Maybe part of the answer was in code up on the wall at the Myers residence. A tall copper sculpture with African symbols, homage to the 14 lost and rediscovered. 14 photographs of beautiful, intricate wooden boxes all deep in the ground now. And the photo of a small black woman with a huge tattooed white man, both deep in thought next to one of the ossuary boxes. Perhaps I read too much into a moment's image, but something in the photograph speaks to me of grace and hope and reconciliation.
Thank you for those beautiful words. You're listening to the KBO Radio Bike Show, hosted by Nedra Deadweiler and Alon Raab. And we have been speaking with climate scientist and ardent cyclist and author, Dr. David Goodrich. And I hope you could join us tonight at 7 as Dr. Goodrich reads at Powell's Books from his latest book. Thank you, David Goodrich, for being with us today and sharing your knowledge and love of cycling, and much success with your work and life. In the second half of the show, co-host Nedra Deadweiler will speak with cyclist and activist Lindsay Caron Epstein, who survived a hit and run and speaks and writes about trauma and resilience. Nedra, take it away.
Okay, thank you, Alon. That was a great interview, and please keep me updated of how your show goes tonight. Hello, thank you, KBOO, for the show today, and Lindsay Caron Epstein, are you here with us?
Yes.
Yeah.
Hello, Nedra.
This is Nedra. Yeah, I'm really excited to meet you through the radio station and just have you to share your story today. It is a pleasure to have you, and looking forward to hear your chat. Well, it was the quote of you on an article that said your goal is to inspire people. So I think this show is all about inspiration. So yeah, looking forward to hearing some being inspired by your work in advocacy. So can you tell us a little bit about who you are what inspires you on the day to day?
What inspires me? Say that again.
I'm doing the day to day, just every day. Yeah. You know, life can be a little bit of a fog.
Since I was hit, I've changed my inspirations, and it's now. I mean, it's always been about healthcare. Like, we should have universal healthcare, and I previously made a documentary about universal healthcare, and now all of a sudden, I just spent 5 months in the hospital, and my bills were over $10 million. So that's wild. But the new inspiration, because I was injured so badly that doctors informed my family that I would not survive. And I did. And I healed incredibly well, like much better than anyone would have expected or that data relays. So I'm hoping now to find a neuroscientist who wants to research why the heck I healed so well so we can help others. Yeah. And there's kind of a new movement. I just saw a neuroscientist speak, a new movement that doctors should not share the prognosis with the family. Mm-hmm. That they should just keep working on the patient to see how it goes. Because if you tell family or loved ones that their person is not going to survive, that's not good for anybody. It's not good for the patient. It's not good for the family. Like, how do you heal someone if you're like, oh, well, this isn't going to work? You have to believe, oh, we can read to them, we can sing to them. I know that even though they're not responsive, they can probably hear us. Like, that's the kind of energy you need to have.
Yeah. I you bring up a really great, important point about healthcare, about even the change in your identity before your accident, after your accident. And then just how do we stay not even inspired but positive? What is the outlook that we need to nurture when we're healing? And also that the fact that you overcame some serious odds. So what is, you said 5 months.
Yeah.
What type of work went into your recovery? What has taken place for you to get to where you are right now?
I do not remember 4 months. And I had to relearn to walk, talk, recognize my family. Like, I didn't have a brain function initially. And, and so apparently when I did start speaking intelligible words, I was just kind of making things up. Like, alligator helicopter sky. Alligator helicopter sky? Why isn't anyone... Like, I was frustrated that no one understood what I was saying and I was not speaking logic. And then when I was discharged from the hospital, I was still... The doctors said I would always need a wheelchair and I would always be on feeding tubes and I would need an at-home nurse. And I thought that was weird. And then, like, I left the hospital and I was like, I'm going for a walk. And my parents were like, you can't go for a walk. And I'm like, I can walk 5 miles, which I just went and did. And... I just kept doing that. The stairs were really scary, and I just kept taking the stairs until they got easy. Belief. And so that's why now I want to tell, I've met a handful of other miracle survivors who were not supposed to survive their deep prognosis. And I want to tell all our stories because I think it's important when you have some pancreatic cancer, you know, and you look and the data says only 4% survive. Like, oh God, this is not going to do well. But if you have one person who is a public speaker who's saying, I survived that and look how great I'm doing, then I think that is a more, if their testimony surpasses the anonymous data, that is probably beneficial for family members to hear that.
Yeah. What is it called? Modeling, you know, seeing someone who's done, overcame the odds, it shows like it can be done. And that alone is inspiration. With the few people, because you said you've met a few others. So the three of you or the handful of you, what are some of the themes of your stories that you would like to put into a documentary?
Okay, so there, I've got a number of cancer survivors, but similar to me, it's the traumatic brain injury people. And there's this thing called the Glasgow Coma Scale, which is the rating of the severity of a brain injury. And most brain injuries are mild. If you have a concussion, you probably have a mild brain injury. And most people don't know that. And they're like, oh, I just banged my head. I'm dizzy for 4 months. Why am I still? You should go to the doctor. And they'll be like, oh, look at that. There's a brain injury. Anyway, so those are the mild ones. Severe brain injuries are very less common. Like only 10% of brain injuries are severe. And on the Glasgow Coma Scale, they have a rating of 3 to 8. The Glasgow Coma Scale rates from 3 to 15. 15 is being perfectly healthy, 3 is brain dead. And I had a 3. And the statistics say that 89% of people with a 3 die within 30 days. 7% are permanently in a coma. 4% have permanent neurological damage. And, like, those are horrible statistics. And so now I know 4 other people who survived a Glasgow Coma Scale of 3 or 4. And it's apparently very challenging to get a hospital to admit patients with that severe of a rating.
Wow.
And when I first started Googling it, Glasgow Coma Scale 3, the first things I saw were doctors are like, oh, well, this isn't going to work. Should we just try a little something? And that's not good. So I want to share the stories of the people who have survived Glasgow Coma Scale 3 or 4, because more hospitals should be like, no, 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 we can save them. And the medical practitioners should be like, no, no, we can save them too. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's an important point that you start around healthcare being a human right. It's not a question, but it's something that should be given and extended. You were a part of Bike League's advocacy this past March at the Capitol.
Yeah.
How was that your first experience as the Bike League? How was that for you? How was that conference? How was the summit?
It was really awesome. It was really impactful. I was with a nonprofit called Families for Safe Streets. And Families for Safe Streets started because their loved ones were killed while cycling. So they started this organization. And now there's multitude, all the members either lost a loved one or someone who was severely critically injured while they were cycling by vehicles. So in my head, we were going to be the only people talking about that at the National Bike Summit. And the rest of it's going to be like, how do we get more people to ride bikes? But it was very diverse. There were multiple people that had been injured while cycling. There were multiple variety of disabled people. And we did all these walking audits of if you're in a wheelchair or if you're visually impaired, can you walk these four blocks? And so it was really impactful to have that perspective. And then there were certain pieces of legislation that we were lobbying for, and we met with our legislative congressional members about those pieces of legislation.
Mm-hmm.
It was awesome.
Oh, that sounds great. Yeah, I've been to the summit maybe twice. It's been a while now, and it's always, I found it exhilarating to meet other people. For me, other women of color, other people doing kind of grassroots work, and to hear how they are like strategize within their communities to advocate. And with the addition of doing street audits and just looking at accessibility for and what spaces and how they're accessible for is a very good question. You know, especially as there's infrastructure dollars that have been coming from the federal government to go into communities to, you know, either build new, to repair, to retrofit. There's all kinds of work that can be done, but having the input of folks who are on in a wheelchair or who, like you said, differently abled, children, older people, it makes a difference to have that input. Is this something that you are bringing into your advocacy, or did it just a good learning experience for you?
I think just a good learning experience, and there were definitely, I mean, virtually everyone there, that is their career. They have made bicycle advocacy careers, and mm-hmm. that's inspiring. And so if I get to the point where it's my career, I will certainly include other ability perspectives as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But, I mean, even your own is a good starting point.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that is missing, you know? So, you were there. I was wondering if you got a chance to meet any, like, Earl Blumenhauer, if you got a chance to meet him or any other legislator that is in healthcare or maybe have committee assignments in like safety or infrastructure?
I had a meeting scheduled with Earl Blumenauer's assistant, and then mm-hmm. it was canceled at the last minute. But I'm still hoping that I go meet with him or one of his assistants in Oregon.
Yeah.
Because he's both the bike cop. First of all, he's awesome. But then he also runs the bike caucus and the neuroscience caucus.
Right.
Brain injury. Biking.
So even though we're not Congressperson Earl Blumenauer, what would you say what would you say to him?
Obviously I want my story to impact legislation. So if there is, I already mentioned the Glasgow Coma Scale 3 perspectives. How do we get people to actually admit patients that have that? And then, of course, advocating for cycling advocacy. There are bike lanes being removed right now in various cities around the country. That's crazy. Why would you? And it's They're when crazy. There's legislation to put in new bike paths, people are like, oh gosh, that'll take away a parking spot from my business. No. Various ridiculous reasons. And so your $1 of taxes that it would cost to put in a protected bike lane, that seems more astonishing and negatively impacts you and your business than the $10 million that might cost an injured person to go get health care? Those are stories we need to tell.
Yeah, that's good perspective. It's like, what is the cost? You know, who is really, what costs are there, and who's really suffering? No one's suffering from not having to walk a little bit further. If they're driving and wanted to park somewhere, that's probably a good thing. That'll help us all be healthier to walk a little bit more. But having a protected bike lane will make a difference to someone who is being injured. What is your riding like now? You're back in the saddle, and what was your
next week, this weekend, I'm riding the 5-Borough Bike Tour in New York City.
Oh, my. Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks. And I'm riding it with the nonprofit Love Your Brain. And Love Your Brain is this awesome nonprofit. They give free resources to traumatic brain injury survivors or their families. And they do yoga, meditation, retreats, and community building for brain injury survivors. And their annual fundraiser is a bike ride.
Oh,
so that's cool.
Sounds like a great organization. It's doing some really good work. Yeah.
They just won. One of their co-founders, the two brothers are the co-founders. The original brother got his brain injury because he was a snowboarder training for the Olympics, and he was like the, you know, number one, number two snowboarder in the world. And he flipped and got a brain injury, and similar, like, wasn't supposed to survive. Also had a Glasgow Coma Scale 3. And went to, like, one of the few hospitals in the country that admits you. And then him and his brother started Love Your Brain. And his brother was just nominated by CNN as an annual superhero.
Hmm. Wow.
And now I'm riding with them in New York.
And then you're riding with them in New York. Yeah, that sounds pretty fabulous, and that you'll have some good company.
Yeah.
Yeah, so resources have come around you to support you in your, like, continuation of your life, basically, it sounds like.
Yeah, I'm working on it. I mean, there's obviously, I have 4 different states that I've lived in the past year, and I'm supposed to have six neuro doctors that I see a year that are kind of taking care of me. And I went from 24 hours of care for 5 months to getting out of the hospital, going to a neuro doctor, and like, oh, you look like you're in great condition. We'll see you next year. I'm like, wait, I went from 24 hours of care to 20 minutes a year.
Wow. Wow.
And then insurance stuff, like, we're the only advanced country in the world that doesn't provide universal health care.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We need to pay for insurance.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have insurance and you have to pay for it out of pocket, it's like state specific.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you can't be a vagabond, can't move around or travel. Gotta stay in one place.
Yeah. Accessibility of healthcare, affordability of healthcare. So, yep, like there still is a big need for many things to come together to make your life easier and people who are in your position to have, to like recover fully and to regain complete mobility.
Yeah.
In many ways. Yeah.
I've got a fun statistic I want to share. So most people don't even know TBI, traumatic brain injury. They're like, what's a TBI? Mm-hmm. There's 2.5 million new cases of traumatic brain injury in the U.S. every year. Comparatively, there are 250,000 new cases of breast cancer in the U.S. every year.
Mm.
So 10 times more TBIs. And everyone knows the pink ribbon, and they raise billions of dollars to support breast cancer survivors, and there's no organization that is providing financial or emotional or case management support for brain injury survivors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a list, and important for you to call out. And I think it's good for you to share it now, especially this is Bike Month. And we see a lot of riding challenges. You know, go out and ride this many hours during Bike Month, be it in May or in October, Biketober for October, you know, be it by yourself or with a group. You've just shared about traumatic brain injury and some of the data, you know, we look and even the awareness that we have, be it because there is like a symbol that is for, I guess, the industry that breast cancer has become, but there's not that for traumatic brain injury. What else would you share for people who are advocates, be it in their community in different ways, but also just specifically to the bike community? What is it that you, what else would you add to that? How can they be supportive? besides the white bike, placing the white bike out, what else can we do to support our comrades who have been hit and injured?
The most common ways to get a traumatic brain injury are like football, very common in the military, and then cycling is the number one sport that leads to it.
CTE.
So, yeah. So that's fun. how can people support? I think that it's different outcomes for everybody. A brain injury is unique and how it impacts people, right? Different parts of your brain control different parts of your body. So what part of your brain got injured? The left rural, which controls that part of your body or that part of your mind. So it's different for everyone depending on what got injured and how well you put it. Okay, so I am hoping that a neuroscientist wants to research why the heck I healed so well. But without that, I've been mostly vegetarian and organic, like since I was 10. I've been incredibly active, outdoorsy, athletic for my life. That's a cycling and hiking and skiing. And maybe between those comparisons of things, my body was like, okay, we can do this. My brain was like, this part of it doesn't work anymore. Maybe this part can take over those functions. You know, so there's lots of reasons to live a healthy life. And we are so educated by media to be sexy. Like, go on a diet, exercise so that you can look good. Well, but it makes you live longer. It could extend your age, but also help you heal. If you're in the hospital and, okay, my first surgery was 12 hours. That is incredibly uncommon. Most people's organs do not subside under anesthesia for more than 3 or 4 hours. So most people, that would have been 4 separate 3-hour surgeries. My organs were strong enough to be under anesthesia for 12 hours. Don't know why, but I'm just assuming it's because I'm exercising, athletic, eating mostly vegetarian, organic. Like, that probably is why my organs were strong enough to handle that. And that certainly was the initiation of my medical care.
Yeah, that's, health is more than something that's superficial. It is literally skin deep, and it can save your life. We are winding down in our time. I mean, it's been really insightful. You're a great educator. And before we turn it back over to Alon to wrap up and close out the show, I wanted to just see if you had any other things that you wanted to share that you didn't get a chance to.
Sure do. More than I had time for. But
My other new disability is hydrocephalus, and no one knows what that is. But we all have cerebral spinal fluid in our brains, and it's all naturally removed from the brain. If it stops removing, then you have hydrocephalus.
Right.
And hydrocephalus can be very fatal if it's not noticed and fixed. And the only way to fix it, so I now have a VP shunt. It's a pipe that goes from my brain to my pelvis with a pump. And that pump is removing the cerebral spinal fluid from my brain. And that is there for life. And now I have to go get a neuroscientist to give me a CT scan every year to make sure the pump is still working. That's it. That's all I got time for.
Well, Lindsay, I wish you the best, you know, for speedy recovery, that you will find that researcher that is, hopefully maybe they're listening in or tuning in later, and that you also get a chance to talk to Congressperson Blumenauer to encourage the importance of change within within policy. So good luck to you and all the best. Thank you so much for joining us here at KBOO Radio.
Yeah, thank you so much. Cheers.
Mm-hmm. Cheers. Aman, back to you.
Thank you, Nedra, and thank you, Lindsay Carone Epstein, for sharing your story, your struggles, and your recovery. I, as somebody who's no stranger, unfortunately, to bicycle accidents, being hit by a drunk driver, knowing about people who have been injured, my heart goes out to you, and I admire your courage and your faith and the work of good doctors, nurses, and staff, and the support of families. So thank you so much, and be healthy and strong, and never have that bad experience again. And I wish that to all our fellow cyclists. Nedra, what's next for you in the coming month?
Oh, in June, we have bike camp.
Okay.
I do a youth bike camp. And so I have 2 weeks in June and a week in July.
So sitting under the, singing under the stars at night after a long day of cycling, or howling at the moon?
You know, young people howl at the moon, at the sun, at the stars, like they howl all day. Thankfully, this is not overnight. It is just a day-only camp, and it's riding to get some bike skills. That's 2 weeks to two. Two of the weeks are like bike skill camp, so it's a lot of riding, learning rules of the road, how to make turns, how to look for cars, how to ride on the streets as well as on trails. And then the last camp is my camp. It's city riding, and so kids are learning how to navigate in a city and, like, locations, history. And I think this year I'm going to teach them about maybe how to be a tour guide.
Oh, cool. And for those of our listeners who don't know, Nedra has a wonderful organization called Civil Bikes, and where she leads bicycle tours in Atlanta along sites connected with history and resistance. So that would be great to share that with a new generation of cyclists.
Yes.
All right.
I love young people. Well, what about for you? We got a few minutes. What's up for you?
For me, just my regular activities. I'm also involved in writing for an Iranian publication about the history and culture of women cyclists in the Middle East. And I hope that at a future show, the Iranian people that I've been in contact with, who are bicycle activists in Iran, could be on our show, assuming that the political situation would allow that. But it's been very inspiring for me to be in contact with these individuals who I won't mention by name right now, but who are in the midst of, you know, their country going through some very difficult times, or riding bikes, organizing, and these are men and women. So, all right, Nedra, I will say goodbye for now. And as always, it's a pleasure and an honor to co-host with you. And same. We'll be in touch. Take care of yourself.
You do the same, Alon.
Okay. You have been listening to the KBO Bike Show. My name is Alon Rob, and I would like to thank my co-host, Nedra Deadweiler, our guest, David Goodrich and Lindsay Carone Epstein, our engineer today, Ray Bodwell, Chris Smith and Josh Hedrick for making all shows available on www.bikeshowportlandtransport.com. And a big thank you to you, our listeners. And I hope that the coming month is a good one for you and the world. I hope that the days ahead will see more actions towards making our home, the Earth, more bike-friendly, environmentally conscious, and centered not on greed and hate, but on human and planetary needs, survival, and flourishing. Thank you for joining us today. May all your rides be safe, enlightening, and joyful.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Jazz Lives, right after these news headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy miércoles 3 de mayo del 2023. Una explosión en la región occidental de Bryansk, fronteriza con Ucrania, descarriló un tren de carga ruso el lunes, dijo el gobernador local en una publicación en las redes sociales. Estalló un artefacto explosivo no identificado, como resultado de lo cual descarriló una locomotora de un tren de carga, dijo el gobernador de Bryansk, Alexander Bogomax, en Telegram, y agregó que no se reportaron víctimas. Las imágenes compartidas en las redes sociales